Welcome to another Software Defined podcast, today focused on yet another network operating system, because the three or four that we have is just not good enough. I'm Ivan Pieplniak, and I'm the regular host of this podcast. You can find the previous episodes on podcast.ipspace.net. And as almost always, with me today is David G. David, how are you doing today?
Yeah, I'm not bad, thank you. Looking forward to Christmas. As always, I'm in front of customers trying to change the world around kind of programmability and networking, which is always good fun. How about yourself? How are you? You well?
Survived the SDN road trip. I was running like 8 or 9 workshops throughout the autumn, probably vaccinated around 200 people against SDN disease. So yeah, fun times.
Sounds great. Is that available in pill form yet?
No. It will be packaged as a red pill eventually.
Uh-huh. Sounds good.
Yeah, right now it takes 3 days to be vaccinated.
Oof.
I'm working on a condensed formula, but not there yet.
Will that be software delivered?
Of course. Over the internet.
Awesome. 3D printed.
And if no one has recognized the voice yet, that was Chris Young from HP. Chris, how are you doing these days?
I am actually just coming back from beautiful sunny London. I'm just leaving the spot for the laughter. We just had our HP Hewlett-Packard Enterprise, as we did this little split, so now the name is official, Discover. So we're out there in London last week, and I am 5 hours out of my time zone and had just a blast hanging out and chatting with customers and former coworkers. So Dave Tucker of Docker fame was there. So that was a wonderful thing to see people from the past and hopefully from the future. So
nice. How was the event? Was it okay?
The event was great, actually. A ton of energy. The whole Aruba, HP networking legacy all came together. Customers everywhere. It was actually one of the better events that I've attended in the last few years. So
awesome.
Lots of interesting things to come.
So what were you doing there, and what are you doing in the bigger scheme of things at HP Enterprise?
So I am a technical marketing engineer in the HP networking, Aruba, whatever this new organization. Basically, I do networking. And really my function is to, as I like to kind of tongue in cheek, I try to make sure that the marketing people lie up the least amount possible. That's really kind of my role.
You're my hero.
I try. I didn't say I can do it completely, right? So... but really just try to take, you know, what R&D is doing and what people like Michael and Diego and translate what they're doing into business value and help customers understand how things like network programmability can actually help them provide more to their business, right? Because that's really what this should be all about at the end of the day, is not just technology, but why do people do this stuff? So I'm also kind of, you know, on this side of the pond doing the same as David, trying to make people understand how network programmability and automation can make their lives better.
Let's hope you succeed.
I'm trying. You know, just one more.
So you already mentioned Michael and Diego. Will you introduce them?
I will let them introduce themselves because they do far more than I could ever remember.
So my name is Michael Zayed, and I'm the architect of OpenSwitch, the project that we're going to talk about today. If I go a little bit back into my background, I started going into networking at 90s. Mostly for video distribution and then distributed out of service, and then was acquired into Cisco as a startup, and spent quite some time in Cisco working on security through routing, through WAN, all these different areas. And for the last year, basically, I'm at HP, and now HPE, that's our name after the split, and working on this project.
Perfect. Diego?
Hi, my name is Diego Lompe. I am software architect from HPE Networking. I'm actually out of Costa Rica right now. My work in networking started about 3 years ago in the Procure product line of HPE. And for the last year, also, I have been working along with Michael and some other members of the team on the OpenSwitch project, where my main contributions are in infrastructure and some of the software and Linux architecture.
Okay, so by now you guys mentioned OpenSwitch like 2 or 3 times, and no one knows what that is, so let's fix that. What is OpenSwitch?
Michael, this is your baby. Why don't you go on this one?
Okay, OpenSwitch is basically an open source and what we believe is going to be an open community network operating system for switches or for networking devices, right? Because we don't necessarily want to restrict it. our first and foremost focus is on the top-of-rack switches because the hardware is kind of open source by now, but it's not going to stop there, obviously.
So it's a network operating system.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Why would we need another one? What's wrong with Cumulus Linux, for example? Why did you decide to build this one as opposed to just use the other one?
So we looked at the landscape of network operating systems that we have today. Obviously, we have the traditional closed source, you know, Cisco, Arista, other companies. And then if you look at the new entrants like Cumulus or Big Switch, they're addressing quite different needs, I would say. So if you look at Big Switch, it's more of the SDN controller-based architectures that work for some of the customers, don't necessarily work for other customers. When I look at Cumulus, what I mainly see is the difference of the management paradigm. If you want to really manage your switch as in Linux and you like the idea of working through the configuration files, installing different packages, managing them, maybe going through some management tools, then Cumulus is definitely a very interesting approach for you. If you're more used to go through consolidated management approach of network operating systems, where everything is in the same startup configuration, startup file, or you know, you have running configuration that shows everything together, that has consolidated and consistent ways of managing the device, troubleshooting the device, understanding what's happening inside the device, where different protocols work the same way, then that's what we're trying to achieve. So that's the main difference for me. The completely separated way of Cumulus, of Linux, basically, where everything, every single piece is working a different way, or the more traditional network operating system approach where things are work consistently in a coordinated fashion, not just at the data plane, not just at the routing table level, but at the control plane as well.
Another way to explain what Michael just said is the operational experience of who's actually consuming the network as a device. There are a lot of great Linux people out there, and Linux has an amazing following. Not all networking guys are really good Linux people. And if you look at from an operational standpoint, a lot of the, especially in enterprise networking, the idea of operations in general has really evolved around this concept of a monolithic single configuration file. So if you want to do PCI compliance or, you know, you name it, SOX, whatever it is, they kind of have this, here's your config file, is what you're being asked for. You can't really get a single config file out of a Cumulus Linux box. So that was one of the main differentiators, is that the OpenSwitch has really been designed from the ground up to be consumed programmatically, but also from traditional networking people, so that we can go into it and have a very, very familiar experience. If you've been through XYZ vendor's training program in the last 15 years, you'll probably be okay.
So you took a look at how Linux networking is glued together from 20 incompatible bits and pieces, and you went like configuring ECLS with IP tables, and configuring QoS with TC, and configuring routing with Quagga. That just doesn't work for most people, right?
And don't forget NTP and SNMP and syslog, and yeah, exactly.
Oh, and RA daemon for IPv6 and all that stuff, yeah.
All that stuff, yeah. So Linux people, and again, that doesn't, it's great for people who are traditional Linux, you know, operations people, but
Let's put it this way. I've heard a comment saying that there are probably three people in the world that understand TC, and no one knows who the third one is. I was looking at that thing, it was like, no, I'm not touching this.
So another important aspect for us in OpenSwitch is that leaving aside the fact of the configuration and networking management as well, one of the great things about OpenSwitch is, as the name said, it's actually open in the sense that you can actually go to the website today and you can literally clone the source code and you can build it. It's not that you will find a small piece of the code here or upstream of the contributions and you can put it together yourself. But we actually went to the lengths of creating a full developer environment and be enable the community and the customers to be able to actually build the source code in a fully open source project manner, kind of like OpenStack.
So you're saying that in your case, you get this huge tarball of source code Whereas in case of other Linux network operating system distros, you get packages from all over the place that you have to pull together to get the desired end result.
The other way, you know, open source is just a medium to an end. So the way I will actually say it is, if you want, with OpenSwitch, if you want to try something different, if the protocol that you're running, that we're providing is not what you need, but you want to modify this silly little configuration that you want, that you will have for another vendor to wait for a couple of years to get the change back in the code base. If you have the skills and the team, you can actually go and change. And that's completely unleashed innovation from, it's a departure from the traditional models. Because now, if you want to change a small bug in Quagga, you can go ahead and do it and still leverage this whole operating system with this small patch that a developer could do. And this is very important for some of the DevOps in data, in new data centers, where they say, maybe I want to run, you know, Quagga BGP, I want to run your new BGP stacks now, like Go BGP, or I want to run Beard, or I want to run something else. So actually having the ability to have the source code and being able to customize, give you the true power of open source that is leveraging other people work together to create new solutions.
Yeah, but now you are sort of preaching the difference between open source and traditional vendors. Yeah, we get that.
Yes, but the good thing, I think Chris mentioned wisely, is that you're getting both works, right? So OpenSwitch is providing you with the traditional work that networking engineers are used to, but we're also trying to give access to tap into all this power from the open source that is driving revolutions in different markets.
This is interesting. Okay, so I mean, I've just been in the background listening to some of this stuff, and I'm drawing in front of me. If you take the kind of traditional silos in an enterprise, and you have the networking silo, and let's just call it the kind of sysadmin silo where the kind of compute and storage lives. I guess with the kind of Cumulus play, those guys trying to take networking to the sysadmins using Linux tools and blah, blah, blah. But what you're actually doing is addressing the need to embrace open from a networking silo. And you're giving them the tools that they're familiar with today, but then almost offering them the next step up in their own world instead of giving up control over to that silo. Is that kind of one of the plays that you're looking at right now? Am I understanding it correctly?
I think that's definitely one of the plays. And also, and we'll get into this in a little bit of the architecture piece, but the whole programmatic era that some of us are starting to really embrace. If you look at some of the traditional vendors out there, they're really just layering APIs on top of their traditional monolithic or compartmentalized OSs, whatever that happens to be. But it's the APIs have really been kind of an afterthought.
Sure.
So when we get into the architecture piece, we're providing kind of this, if you're a traditional network guy and you want to log in, you want an SSH, Telnet, console, whatever, and be able to run your show commands, you can absolutely do that and have that traditional experience and leverage those traditional, you know, all the wisdom that we've gained over the years. Wisdom being the experience you get from making bad decisions, right? All of that stuff, we're going to be able to take advantage of the networking team, because networking is hard.
Mm-hmm.
Right. But being able to really from the ground up, which I think you'll see once we go to the architecture piece, have the APIs and the programmatic interfaces done in such a way that we allow the systems teams to really start to codify all of that tribal knowledge that we have in our heads and really allow them to embrace and take advantage of the new programmatic structures that we have available to us. I think it's kind of the best of both worlds in that sense.
So you're effectively saying that traditional networking vendors are implementing API on top of CLI scraping. And you did what Juniper did with Junos, which is start with a data model and then use a data model internally and build an API around the data model and then manipulate that API through CLI or NetConf or XML or REST or whatever, right?
So it's pretty similar. The only interesting difference is that we went more of the way of centralized system data, that we went into the centralized state database. So yes, we have everything modeled, and even more than that, we have everything stored in in-memory database and accessible from outside by standardized protocols.
So the heart of your system is this one centralized in-memory database, right?
Yep, absolutely. So we had quite a lot of experience with these models over our professional lifetime. And what we found is that there are basically two models that you can see in all the different network operating systems. One is around kind of a message bus, where different models communicate to each other and send messages to each other, versus the other one, which has the centralized database, which basically stores the latest state of every data model and provides access to it asynchronously to any interested party. So the few differences between these two models, in the messaging model, you have to actually deliver this message to all the listeners, to all the subscribers of the system, and that creates interesting complications about the speed of all these receivers, how fast they have to pull these messages out, otherwise they will just miss them, and where the latest state is stored. So what happens if receiver crashes and has to come up again and get the information again and stuff like that. That's the messaging paradigm.
So the problem with the messaging paradigm is that the messages are ephemeral, right?
Absolutely, right? And it mostly creates the problems when something bad happens.
Yeah, so you don't have the central state. You have state in every component. And if that component crashes, you lose the state, right?
It's exactly like that. The company that comes up after it crashes, it has to now scream around and say, hey, who has this state, right? Can you resend me these messages? Because I don't know what happens around me.
And then you get into things like OSPF and BGP nonstop forwarding, right? Where you go like, hey, guys, don't panic. I'm almost there, but please send me what you know about me, right?
Yes, and many other pieces, right? So, you know, some piece that, for example, let's say it's responsible for fans. It's coming up and say, hey, guys, what was the temperature? Now, in that case, it's easy, then it will send this message, and then something that is responsible for temperature will send this information over. But with protocols and other things, that's becoming very, very complicated. To the level that in many of these network operating systems, if one of the components fails, then the entire system has to reboot. Because to restore the state is extremely complicated. Now, with a centralized database, it stores the latest state of basically every data model. So if process crashes, it comes up again and it reads it from the database and it doesn't send any messages to anybody else. So the rest of the system doesn't know that something crashed.
So in theory, an OSPF process could crash and it would restart and the neighbors would still be in the database and the topology database would still be there. So it wouldn't have to go through the adjacency establishment and all that stuff, right?
For some protocols, yes, that's something that can happen. For some protocols, let's say it's BGP and BGP TCP based, so TCP connection dropped, right? So there is a side effect, right? The other side will know that.
Yeah, with BGP, yeah, you lose the session. There's nothing
right,
you can do.
Right, you lose the session.
Yeah.
So for different protocols, for different subsystems, it's going to be handled a little bit differently. But yes, the objective is like that, to store as much information as possible into the central database. So if you crash and you come up again, you can restore your state with the least possible side effect for anything else.
So this sounds great, but the central database always has this problem that everyone has to query and poll it. Like, you know, the initial Neutron plugin with the central MySQL database, and that didn't scale too well, right? So how did you solve that problem?
We use Open vSwitch database, OVSDB, and one of the greatest things about it is that it's very strong on notifications. Basically, different subsystems, they don't poll the database, they subscribe to changes. And whenever there's a change to some piece of the database, then relevant listeners will receive it. Will receive these pieces. So you never have subsystem polling the database. They only get relevant parts that are interesting to them, and what is not interesting to them, they miss.
So it's like persistent message bus, right?
So exactly. So in this case, it's basically a PubSub model that you generally get with message buses, but the latest state is always preserved by the database. Now, what happens is that subscriber may be slow, so subscriber might actually miss some of the messages, right? So if you think about it in messages, then subscriber may not receive all the different messages. If a certain data model goes from state A to B to C, then subscriber may see that it's moving from A to C. What we guarantee is that you will know what the latest state is. We don't guarantee that you will see all the transitions. So it allows us to scale much better. It allows us to have slow subscribers It allows you to write maybe your some of your subsystems in Python and you know in other languages that may not be as fast as the other thing, and you still get the benefits of database. So it's a different way of thinking about it. Never think about receiving all transitions. Always think about this is the latest state and what should I do about getting my piece of system in sync with this latest state.
So instead of receiving transitions, you receive notification that the state has changed, and then you have to go like, okay, what does that mean to me?
So you actually receive the data of the state change together with the notification, and then you have to say, okay, yes, what should I do now, right? What does it mean for me? So let's take an example of OPS SwitchD, which is the daemon that is responsible to translate from the database into the ASIC, into the SDKs, into different SDKs. That's exactly what it does. So whenever some configuration changes, let's say link aggregation is now being formed, or maybe LACP changed some state of one of the interfaces inside link aggregation, it basically analyzes this new state of the database. It receives notifications. It analyzes this new state and decides what should go to SDK. It never assumes that it receives kind of command from the database saying, hey, now add this one to link aggregation, now add that one to link aggregation. No, it basically will say, I now see that I have two link aggregations inside my database. What I previously configured to SDK was one. Let me actually add this one as well. But in a single transaction that it receives from database, everything may change. Five link aggregations may be added, three VLANs might be removed, whatever happens. Because if I'm slow enough, then database will just aggregate all the changes in a single update. And here's my new world. Here's what I configured to the SDK previously. Let me diff it. Let me actually tell the SDK what now has to be done. Essentially, it's a declarative system. What you have inside database is declaration of what is needed. What you should do, you should adapt your subsystem to this declaration.
What do you put in the database?
So in the database, we basically have everything. So you have all the configurations from the user, and then you have all the statuses that subsystems push into the database, and all the statistics. And now we're working on making sure that statistics subsystems specifically will scale nicely. And different protocols are also encouraged. Different protocols, different pieces of system are also encouraged to store whatever they need in order to recover from crashes in the database as well. Now, as they push this information to the database, it's now available for troubleshooting. For example, all the show commands, they will show you status of any subsystem. Another thing that is interesting is that the communication between different subsystems is also through the database. So, for example, temperature daemon publishes temperature into the database, and then fan daemon subscribes to this information and actually changes the speed of the fans, for example. CLI may go and read this information from database and basically can provide show commands that show the temperature, show the fan speed, or whatever is needed. So pretty much everything is inside database.
So for example, in traditional Linux-based networking operating system, you would have Quagga, which would have the different daemons for BGP and RIP and ISIS and OSPF. And then you would have the Zebra daemon, if I remember correctly, that would install that information into the main Linux routing table.
Yes.
So are you saying that you now install the routing table into the system database?
So we integrated Quagga into OpenSwitch, and actually Paul Jackman, he's the maintainer of Quagga. He's now working for HP, and or first and foremost objective is to let him run Quagga because we are dependent on Quagga, so we want to make sure that he continues working on Quagga. So we did the initial integration of Quagga into OpenSwitch, and what happens is now that BGP daemon will publish its routes into the database. And Zebra is routing information base manager, right? So it selects best routes from different sources and says, this route is the best one, let me mark it. So what happens in OPS that BGP will publish routes into the database. Zebra subscribes to this route, receives this route, does its magic, right? Decides, this route is the best, and changes the column of selected inside the database for this specific route and say, this route is selected. Now OPS SwitchD subscribes to the database for this selected route. So it will see, this route is now selected. Let me actually take it to the SDK, to the ASIC. So this is the model. It's going to a database. We don't want different agents of the system to communicate to each other, to send messages, or to some kind of sidebar. It should be exposed to the database. This is the communication mechanism.
But you still need to install the routes in the Linux forwarding table just for the TCP sessions to work, right?
Exactly. So today, the way it works is a little bit not ideal in the long run, but we wanted to get this integration up and running. So today, Zebra will basically be responsible to send routes to the database and send them down to the kernel as well. In the future, we should be able to reevaluate this because from puristic perspective of the architecture, Zebra should publish them to the database and there should be a different daemon that will subscribe to these changes and will configure to the kernel. So, for example, when you configure IPs, let's say CLI configures IPs on the interfaces and writes this information in the database, you have a daemon ported in this specific situation that will take these IPs from database and configure them to the kernel. So today, Zebra is the one that selects the routes and drives them both in the database and to the kernel.
And there's this other thing that I think you could get out of this database that you never could, for example, with Cisco IOS. If all routing daemons publish the routes in the centralized database, you could see all the candidate routes, even if they have the wrong admin distance, right?
Absolutely. So, well, with Cisco, you can also see local RIB of BGP, for example, right? So
yeah, you could see the RIB in BGP, but you couldn't see what BGP proposed to the forwarding table.
Yeah, so in our case, database provides you huge visibility into the system, right? And we really envision that people will start building much more capable monitoring systems. That's what we hear from everywhere. Give us monitoring. Let us actually understand what happens in this network, especially with the introduction of overlays that hide the infrastructure effectively. So we really envision people start building monitoring systems that leverage this huge capability of getting everything from the system, understanding what happens when this LED actually blinked, right? So you can restore the history of what happened on the system if you take this to these updates from database and store them in, I don't know, in Hadoop, and then you want to correlate to the application performance or whatever.
But this database is an in-memory database, right?
Yes.
So you don't have too much space for, let's say, a week of history of changes to the IP routing table, for example.
Absolutely. It doesn't store history in any way. It's always kind of the running state of the system. Now, what people and we hear people in the community actually start talking about is putting agents on OpenSwitch, subscribing to this database, subscribing to the changes, and sending them out. Right? So database sends you updates every time something changes, and you can be selective about what you subscribe to. So take this information that, okay, BGP actually pushed this route. It's not selected, but it's a candidate. You can receive a notification about this event and store it outside. Send it outside. Send it to Hadoop. Send it to Splunk. Send it to anything else. And then later on, if you want to actually correlate what happens in different layers of your network, it's very useful. You can actually understand why, right? So, okay, so BGP peering actually failed. Right, and BGP reported to database, and that's the reason why your web service doesn't work.
So you could use this, for example, to implement the BGP monitoring protocol.
Yes, you can do monitoring for BGP, you can do monitoring for other protocols, for maybe temperature failures in the system, in your boxes, whatever.
Oh, it would also be pretty easy to implement BGPLS. You just look into the OSPF topology database and dump the updates out.
Yeah.
Cool.
The possibilities here are really kind of, when you start looking at the analytics standpoint, you have an off-box client sucking down whatever data set you want, creating that data set over a time series, and then being able to even look things like across your data center from all these different boxes. And if you have a cascading failure, being able to actually look at them at what was the state, how did that, you know, what was the election processes that were happening at a specific time across all those different boxes. It's you look at some of the advanced the machine learning stuff that's going on right now, and the monitoring becomes a really, really interesting part of this.
No, I'm not as forward-looking as you are. I was just thinking about if I could dump all this into Elk, some people would make some interesting stuff out of that.
Yes.
I was just thinking the same thing. And interesting, you've got me thinking about architecture now as well. So, all right. So everything is kind of centered around this database, which all kind of makes sense. And then all of the other kind of, you know, code. So let's say agents or code that implements specific functions. So right now, and I'm kind of completely new to this, I've done some very light reading on it. So I've got the benefit of knowing nothing here. I mean, what, without kind of deep diving too much around languages, I mean, what languages right now are you using? Have you got kind of like common patterns, common frameworks, and common tooling that you're using? So let's say if you wanted to build an agent, for instance, that taught netconf northbound off box, but then obviously kind of interacted with the database. I mean, from a standpoint and developing on OpenSwitch, how would you start that off, and what does that kind of logic look like?
So if you talk about languages, today we code most of the stuff in two languages, in C and Python. Okay. So whatever requires performance is going into C. Whatever is not so much sensitive on performance, we are pushing it into Python. And the decision was mostly driven by the availability of client libraries for OVSDB. Mm-hmm. C and Python are the most available. So right now we actually see inside the community people being very interested in getting Go language in place. So, yes. For example, there is an effort by NTT guys to integrate GoBGP that they implement to work on OPS. They actually made the first integration available by now. So you can configure GoBGP by just configuring the database, and they will take the configurations and do the BGP work. And interestingly, they are leveraging Go libraries that were introduced by Socketplane guys for Docker. So they are taking them, improving them. So Go language will probably be very viable language for OpenSwitch development. Now, if you look at into OVSDB protocol, you'll see that it's very, very simple JSON RPC based. So we definitely envision more libraries for additional languages emerging very easily.
Sure. Sounds good. So from, I mean, for, as a summary then, from the sounds of things that I say, everything performance bases around C and soon to be Golang. And then for flexibility and I guess kind of rapidly adding features, you've got the whole Python support, which kind of it leads me to ask another question then around community and governance. So with, you know, kind of a massive amount of power kind of, you know, comes a great, I guess, a great opportunity to make something great or to add rubbish. It's kind of like how many projects we've been involved in where you've got too much flexibility where something's gone wrong. So from a governance point of view around this, how is it kind of led? Is it just a community right now? Is it just kind of pitch in and jump in? Or do you have a set of governance procedures in place to make sure the code's of a certain quality?
Case, would you like to take the governance question? Or I can provide
No, you can take it. Or Diego?
Okay, so Diego, do you want, because I'm talking too much.
So, okay.
Okay, so...
Okay. Well, I can take it. Just, you know, just.
Hey, I can have a guess. Don't mean to guess? That's all right, go on.
Okay, so let me go first. So currently, as of the project, October 1st is when this really became released out to the world in LinuxCon. And so at this point in time, and this is, you know, there's ongoing changes in this. When it comes out, most of the governance is controlled by HP at this point in time, right? And this is one of the things that we absolutely do not want, because we don't want a vendor-led open washing. You're familiar with the term?
Yeah.
We don't want open washing. We want something. The idea here was to put something out to the market that could be embraced by not just us, but by multiple vendors, and really do something different that in theory can really drive the entire industry forward, right? If you think of from a, you know, Cisco and the Seven Dwarfs, however long you've been in this industry, 80% of the code that we as major networking vendors all produce, it's all the same stuff. So, you know, 8 times 5, you know, that whatever percentage point that is, that's actually duplicated effort that really didn't need to be done. So kind of the idea is what would happen? This is the dream. What would happen if we all start to, just like has been done around the operating system world, revolve around one or two OSs, so you can have your flavors and then really start to add on that differentiation and end up with a much better quality code base. So that only happens if there are other vendors that start to get involved in this as well. So what we've been doing is actively, and this is where I will turn it over to the other guys, actively trying to take that governance model and making sure there's, you know, unit tests are in place on all the code, all that, you know, the typical software development stuff that should be done. but giving over control of sub-projects to other people and from the community, from other vendors, and getting as many people involved as possible, and doing it all out in the open. Right, that's, I think, one of the other critical things that I have been really impressed with is, although we all work at the same company, I'm actually on IRC channels asking questions.
Yeah. Okay.
Right. So I will compliment a little bit. You know, from a high-level governance perspective, I will make a small leak. We actually started discussions with Linux Foundation on bringing the project under the umbrella of Linux Foundation. We hope to complete it in a few months, and then the high-level governance will switch over to Linux Foundation. So just nice. As Chris was saying, we don't want to control this project over time. That's absolutely not the objective. So right now, we as HPE, we are trying to make sure that we just make it successful. Right, so we can be kind of arbiters between different forces, especially if you think about the hardware vendors. You have Broadcom, you have Cavium, you have Mellanox, you have other companies, and they might have conflicting interests. So we, as kind of independent and not interested in any one of them, we can move the entire thing forward. We can work with all of them and make sure that they all can shine inside this operating system. But again, we are involving community. As you can see, if you go to our mailing list and you go to our IRC channels, they're very, very active. We are taking all of our internal discussions into the open so people can actually collaborate and work with us. And we see great responsiveness to what we are doing. Right? So we start discussion about how to do Ansible, and we immediately got Director of Engineering from Ansible actually chiming in and providing inputs. We had discussion on, okay, that's the way we think to do S-Flow. And Peter Fowle from Inmond, he started commenting and saying, no, guys, please do it differently. And you know what? Yes, we have to do it differently. so plans are changing about how to do S-Flow, for example. And so we're taking it all out. Our IRC channel is very, very active. We have weekly IRC chats where everything is being discussed in our agenda that is collected a couple of days ago before this weeklies. But we started getting weekly IRC chats about different topics because just too many people are interested in the same topic. They want to work together. So right now, most of the maintainers are from HPE, right? So because they started it. But for some of the new models, we're basically saying, hey, guys, you actually do it. So right now, some of the vendors, they're thinking about contributing pieces. We are saying, that's okay, that's great, but you're the maintainers, right? So we don't want to be decision makers for this component. And the way that Diego structured it, the way that we have every separate component in a separate Git repo, for example, it allows us to do this stuff. We can give away maintainers roles to different people, to different trusted people, you know, one piece at a time.
Maybe something that we forgot to mention early in the process is that OpenSwitch right now is not a production-ready software stack. It's not a product yet that you can deploy. We actually open-sourced OpenSwitch early October, and it wasn't fully baked because what we wanted is to start getting the feedback from the community on, as Michael was saying, how we implement certain features. So we're still putting together some of the process roadmaps, how to open up. This is what HP is developing, or this is what the partners are developing, giving some transparency to that. But there's this opportunity for people to actually steer the development process and chime in and say, hey, I could really use this feature. And we were actually surprised to see the level of interaction that we are having in the mailing list and in the IRC channels. We start having discussions on how to leverage common stuff. For example, we have chats with people from Cumulus, people from Big Switch. All this is public, is going on in the mailing list. It's quite, of my experience, is quite a level here of collaboration in the networking industry, what we're seeing in the open development of OpenSwitch.
I will tell you, the only part that's a little scary sometimes is you actually get to see the sausage made.
Yeah.
Yeah.
By the way, Chris, a high-level question. Why is HP doing... Well, it's HP Enterprise, right?
Yes.
Okay.
Hewlett-Packard Enterprise.
Yeah.
We are allowed to use either HPE or Hewlett-Packard Enterprise because HP is registered trademark of the other company now.
Okay. So yeah. Why is HPE doing this? What's in it for you guys?
So what's in it for us? What you will see at some point in the future that I'm not allowed to give any specifics around for revenue recognition reasons. You know how they bind us on those.
Yeah, I've seen that slide.
You will see something very similar to what's been done with our OpenStack contributions. I'm not sure where we are right now, but I know for a while we were number one HPE overall in OpenStack contributions. So you will see us bring something based on OpenSwitch back internally and offer that up as a product is what you will likely see in the future. Right, so you will see a vendor-curated edition of OpenSwitch that to kind of have that best of both worlds. You have that complete transparency, but you also have the single throat to choke, somebody who's done all the testing for you, made sure that the libraries that we're using are actually fully vetted, and you can call someone at the end of the day, rather than some of perhaps the other experiences that you might have been used to where you're kind of left with this, I did a Git clone, and then I made it, and then things went wrong and I have no idea what to do with it, right? So what we're really looking forward to is to kind of changing the entire way that this industry is moving. And like I said, eventually you're going to see a curated vendor edition very similar to Helion OpenStack, which is the HP OpenStack edition.
And you can think about it a little bit like Fedora and Red Hat Enterprise Linux, right?
Exactly.
Absolutely.
So we'll create hardened enterprise ready version, which will be open source and we'll stand behind it.
So for people who want to buy support, you'll give them the option.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Oh, wait, can I answer the question again? It's because we're nice.
Oh, yeah, of course.
Okay, yeah.
What was I thinking?
Crazy thoughts.
Yeah. By the way, speaking about bringing this back in-house, does this thing run on HP switches?
So there are a couple models that we've been doing testing on. Absolutely. You know, one of the things that we've also done, which has forced me to gain some new skills, and I am all for that. In the initial release, if you were to go to openswitch.net, you can actually download a full Dockerized version of OpenSwitch by itself or Mininet-based topologies as well. So you can get your hands dirty on it today if you wanted to without having really any gear at all.
Okay.
So you kind of have both options.
And the hardware support, right now, the main target for development that HPE is focusing the resources is on the HPE Alto line, which is joint venture we have with Acton. And you can get support on that line. If you go to our mailing list, you will see also there is all these requests from different people asking for enabling support in new platforms and different platforms. So on the long term, we'll see enablement in the community for other platforms that are not necessarily only HPE. Some of the challenges that we have to go through was how to work with the ASIC vendors as well, right? Because it's being open source, you need to have access to the APIs, and we wanted to have this open. So we actually worked closely during the OpenSwitch development with Broadcom, that was our first partner in ASIC side, to actually get all the APIs that we need present in the OpenSSL Broadcom API, right? In the OpenSSL API. And we'll continue to work with them. We'll be working in the future with our ASIC vendors as well to try to make sure that we got a level of openness so that people can actually develop their code against those SDKs.
Just to go back, so if everything is based on the database, I mean, in order to take something from the database and push it down into the hardware, and for, you know, correct if I'm wrong, it's just a case of, I guess, rewriting that driver or that functionality, that specific functionality. So if I wanted to do something crazy and go, hey, you know what? I want a different front end and a different way of handling things around Open vSwitch. All I'd have to do is kind of rewrite those particular drivers, I guess, and implement it that way around.
So actually, that really, Michael, I'll ask you to tell the story, the CLI bugs the NTT guys found.
Okay.
Yeah, so one of the things that happened, for example, months ago, that NTT guys, they wanted to connect GoBGP instead of Quagga BGP into the database. And then they figured out that some problem exists in CLI, that CLI can actually drive some wrong input into the database. And it was fixed pretty much immediately. So they sent in the question to the mailing list, and the response was, okay, this is already inside. Here's the patch. It's already inside the Gerrit, inside the view system. And it was approved in about an hour and was fixed same day. So it's very easy in the sense of data models are inside the database. And if you want to replace, let's say, Quagga BGP with Go BGP, or maybe our LLDP implementation with some other LLDP implementation, then all you have to do is connect to the model. And other systems, they don't know, right? CLI doesn't know what happened, and REST API doesn't know what happened, because everything is abstracted by data models.
So one question that came up was, could I completely replace the show-based CLI with Juno syntax? And the answer is yes, you could, if you really wanted to.
Okay, now that you mentioned CLI, obviously you can program this whole thing through OVSDB. And I guess you have some REST API with probably JSON. What else?
So for now, what we did, we created CLI, right? That basically interfaces between the human and the database. We created REST API. REST API is pretty much auto-generated right now. It takes the schema of the database and it exposes through HTTP. And we created declarative configuration utility or model. It's accessible either through REST API, through one of the resources, or directly inside the box using some utility. And it allows you to provide full definition, full declaration of the system configuration. Hey, here's the full JSON that explains you how LLDP should be configured and how BGP should be configured and how different interfaces and VLANs and anything. Here's the full JSON that tells you the entire story of the system, and you can drive it into the database through this declarative configuration interface. Now, what happens now is that, for example, Ansible guys, they want to connect to create Ansible models, and they put themselves on top of declarative configuration because it's very convenient. Because systems like Ansible, Chef, Puppet, they're essentially declarative, and that's the way they want to work. So they're coming up on top of declarative. Right now we have CLI, REST API, declarative. We will probably have Ansible very soon by this Ansible contribution. There are the people discussing Chef integration with OpenSwitch. You can see on the mailing list, and people are getting Ruby into the image. So I guess that Chef will come pretty soon. From Puppet, we didn't hear anything. If they hear this podcast, they are more than welcome to connect and get on our mailing list.
So the declarative data model is what we would call startup config, right?
And that's exactly, by the way, what we use for startup config. We don't store CLI as a startup config. We actually store this huge JSON of the entire configuration as the startup config. And when the system boots, it takes this JSON and pushes into the declarative config into the database.
And it makes it so much easier to do a contextual diff. Yeah, that's cool.
And upgrades, not to mention. I mean, I was just going to ask about that. So in terms of, I guess the way you deal with updates changes, doesn't it? I mean, let's say you have a minor update. It's just you might update a little bit of code, or you might push out a new package, or if the database schema changes. I mean, I guess the let's say if you have a major update and a major change to the way you're doing something, I guess it isn't a case of just grab the whole image. It might be a case of just grab something small. So doing that makes life a little bit easier. I'm just trying to imagine, though, kind of reboot scenarios or database purge scenarios and what they would look like.
So having the ability to go through the database, having the ability to fetch the schema, it allows us to get these upgrade systems, you know, as much as we want. Now, if you go right now into the mailing list, you will see that there's a discussion about how to get the versioning correctly, given different images and given different versions. And this is driven by, for example, Ansible guys. They're making this happen. So I think from the infrastructure perspective, we have a very good basis of exposing all this stuff, making sure that schemas are available, making sure that they're versioned. We can provide checksums and such. How we'll evolve all the different upgrade procedures, that still has to be seen. For the basic, for the easy, for the simple ways, obviously it's going to be pretty easy, if you just extend, get additional features and stuff like that. What happens if you move from image with ABC features to image with B, C, and D features, and what happens to the startup configuration and how we actually trim it and how we apply it, that's something that has to be developed as well. So I will second what Diego was telling before. We basically worked on this project before we released it to open source for about 6 months. That's it. Right? And we started from the team of probably like 4 engineers, 5 engineers, and we have been growing it all the time. So we didn't want to bring this project to the community in a baked form. We wanted to get it very early, to the people. We actually set the date before when we just started, and we said whatever we have by that date, we'll take it out. So many of these aspects, they are still being in discussions, in development, and people are already contributing from the outside. They say, hey, let's not do it this way, let's do it that way. And I definitely expect the system to adjust and go the way that people think it's the right way to go.
So in other words, David, it's too early to think about upgrades.
Yeah, in other words, David, shut up. Don't ask that one.
it's in other words, David, get on the mailing list and bring your thoughts.
I absolutely will. And this is quite interesting. So from an integration and programmability point of view, I mean, trying to expose features on a device, from a switch or a reader, or even if it's kind of a virtual appliance, and build code that, you know, understands that or even just kind of abstractly harnesses it. If a problem comes along, you end up, from an upstream point of view, mending your automation code because there's nothing you've traditionally been able to do about the code on box. And this opens a world of possibilities where if something comes along, maybe that's, you know, it's a bug, you can go back and fix a bug on box and maybe leave the automation code alone. So some of the conversations I'm having right now are fear around all the glue code that's beginning to tie things together. Not only now do we have vendor bugs creeping back in all the time, creeping back in, they're always creeping in. But also, as we add complexity on there to increase automation, we have a whole new kind of plane of problems coming in. And now, at least, I guess, with this model, we have the ability to go to either side and make those changes. So that's pretty cool, really.
Yeah, there's no middleware where you end up having to write Python code to take an abstraction on top of the vendor's abstraction pull out this other side channel to be able to actually, you're doing ASN 2.1 notation because it was only implemented in MIB. So you're still at that, your brain hurts.
Yeah.
But just the idea of having JSON as the startup configuration is really cool. I mean, from the automation perspective, it makes things so much easier.
It does. And what having had a little bit of experience through working for HPE, but trying to keep real, having a whole bunch of different vendors, playing with different virtual images, the fact that it is accessible from this programmatic side, and that's almost the first thought instead of an afterthought, but still having been able to take in the last, I won't date myself, the last years of my experience as a networking engineer, and still being able to even do things like go and configure BGP and then look at the database side through the RESTful API to see actually how things that I've known how to do for 20 years, how that gets expressed through that JSON declarative interface, or how that gets pulled out through a RESTful interface, and really reverse engineering the system so that I can teach myself to code better by applying my older skills. So it's you're not just leaving behind, you know, some of this, the networking people who are left with nothing in a lot of cases, the code or die mentality that's kind of happened in our industry. It really allows networking people a much smoother path to get into this new programmatic era.
And that kind of swings, though, Chris, right back to, I think, one of my earlier points about you taking the ability and the opportunity right now to the networking silos, where, I mean, it's the likes of Cumulus goes and offers that kind of to the Linux world and go, hey, you can do your top of rack, you know, you don't need those network guys. But with this, you're giving those guys opportunity and actually a chance at kind of staying relevant, which is, you know, I think, huge, really.
Absolutely. It's I had a conversation once with some programmers and long conversation at the end of it resulted in, I'm assuming you're not a good programmer. I can tell you they're not good networking people, right? Fallacies of distributed computing. We're still there 20, 30 years later, right? So being able to incorporate those traditional skills and history and bring that forward and provide a path, a career path. Not everybody's going to make it, but that's called evolution. And I'm okay with that.
You wouldn't believe the discussion I had a few days ago with Nick Braglio, who was deploying an SDN solution in production in one of the conferences. And he went like, yeah, you know, all this hype about programmers and coding, that's great, until it gets to troubleshooting, and then they stand no chance.
Yeah.
He had some interesting problems troubleshooting ARP, and he went like, you know what? The programmer was looking at that and he had no clue what's going on.
Yeah.
What's an ARP?
Exactly.
We don't need those. Let's just delete it all. It's obviously something weird, right?
Yeah, exactly. We don't need that.
I'm sorry, you're just dealing with the wrong abstraction. That was your problem.
So A stands for abstraction. Good. Thank you.
Yes.
By the way, you mentioned ASICs like 15 minutes ago, and I know that that's where every single open project stumbles and stops being open, because at a certain point you have to start dealing with the ASIC vendor SDK, and that thing cannot be open. So for example, yeah, you can get the things that Cumulus released in open source form, and you can get a better quag out of Cumulus or whatever. But no, you can't get the thing that actually copies the kernel table into Broadcom ASIC. So how did you guys solve this problem?
It's a great question. So actually, we did get that in OpenSwitch. So when we started with OpenSwitch, and we say we want to make this open source, one reason to make it open source is because we really want the developers and the people to be able to build it. And for us, what's critical, that part that you're mentioning, we want the people that have the source code to the part that talks to the Broadcom SDK, right? We started working with Broadcom that is doing this open source Broadcom API with Apache license. So basically, Broadcom is giving you a binary blob with SDK and this open API they're creating. We actually work with Broadcom so we can make sure that they have the right set of APIs that we need for the features that we were developing for OpenSwitch, right? We also work with them through some of the legal stuff. There are some challenges, for example, not only in the SDK itself as using as a binary blob in user space on Linux, but also because there are some kernel models involved. And in the original model, they actually give us kernel blobs, but that's very problematic when you're building for different platforms, because if you make a small kernel change or you add a feature, then your binary kernel models doesn't work anymore, so you're done. So we actually worked with them in legal. Actually, Broadcom was kindly enough to work with us, and they actually open sourced their kernel side models of their SDK, and that's actually in source code from already in our website. And we work with them so that for the platforms that OpenSwitch we're supporting from the HPE side, we are actually building the binary blobs and publishing the binary blobs for the SDK in the website. The header files, the APIs are open, and the kernel models are in source code form as well. So actually, in OpenSwitch, you have the openness on the interaction with the SDK that you won't find in Cumulus or BigSwitch, because they weren't able to work that out. We're working with our ASIC vendors already, and Michael can give some more insight in that. We're talking to their big vendors. They're also on the loop of making those APIs open. Michael?
Yeah. So I'll give some very simple perspective. We demanded ASIC vendors to provide open APIs. We understand that the SDK itself, it might have intellectual property, or, you know, mostly exposing the intellectual properties inside the ASIC, and it's very, very hard for them to expose it. But what we told them that we cannot work with closed source APIs. So Broadcom is open sourcing APIs. We now work with all the other vendors, and it's pretty public that they work there on our mailing list, Mellanox, Cavium, Barefoot, and we provided exactly the same request to all of them. Hey guys, you have to provide open source APIs. So the driver that translates from the database to the SDK is open. The driver itself is completely open. If people want to add additional features, they can. If people want to change the way that ARP works, or I don't know, or LACP works, or anything else, they can do it. It's open source. The SDK itself, fine. That will be binary that HP will build for the community and will put it into the Git. But the APIs have to be open, and we got very good response from Broadcom, and they worked on enhancing OpenNSL project for us on a daily basis, basically. And they opened all the APIs that we needed for these features that we have by now, and they worked to open additional APIs for all the other features. And the same way we work with other vendors. All of them, they will start actually publishing their plans on the mailing list in the very, very near future. And they will tell, you know, their strategies about how they open the APIs and how they allow this open source development.
So I get a binary blob on your website that talks to Trident 2 chipset. And that binary blob has a function entry point, which I can use to call to install a MAC address in the MAC address table, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yes, right. So it's not just on the website, it's in the Git repositories, right? So it's part of the build system. You don't have to download it separately, just make and install.
So, and that's really kind of a good point where we're saying where it's located in the website is we're in a lot of senses, we're not actually talking. The word we right now is OpenSwitch, a lot of the cases. So everything will be on OpenSwitch.net, on the OpenSwitch infrastructure. It's not HPE as a thing, as an entity.
Okay, so let's go down this path. If I want to play with this thing, where do I get it?
So if you want to get started, you can go to OpenSwitch.net. And as you were saying, this is not HPE.com. This is actually OpenSwitch.net. And all this infrastructure that we have in OpenSwitch.net actually is completely hosted in Amazon Cloud. It's a separate account. So when we design it from the ground up so that when we open source it and give it to a governance model, wherever it's going to be, we actually can just hand off the permissions and the ownership of the instances in Amazon that holds the whole infrastructure. So you can go to OpenSwitch.net. Here you will find a website with a lot of documentation that tell you if you want just to play with it, you know, what's the hardware that we support, how to load the image you can play with it. Chris mentioned earlier, right now we have one piece of hardware, the AF5712, which is an OCP design that you can download an image for. We also have a Dockerized image that you can play with. I'm also taking the action item by next week. We should have an OVA file, a virtual machine that you can actually download as well. And you can play with it in your VMware or your VirtualBox. And as a user, you can play with it, right? It's very nice if you want to see the CLI, you want to play with the configuration, that should get you started. One of the things with the Dockerized image and the OEA that we'll have is that we actually have a software switch model in that. So actually, it's a software image that actually is switching packets. It's using internally, actually, OESDB for it. So it's a simulator. But it's quite useful if you are getting familiar with the CLI or the JSON or the REST or just getting a sense of the open switch without playing with the hardware. Now, that's if you are a final user. If you are a developer and you want to contribute code, in the website you also find a lot of information about how to get started with the developer environment and how to contribute code. The infrastructure for developing code for us when we start thinking about OpenSwitch was we don't want to just go ahead and, hey, here's the open source code. I'm going to throw it over the fence to some GitHub repository. And there you go. There's source code. You figure out what to do with it. We want the people to be able to build it, debug it, test it the same way that we do, right? So we create the whole build system, the whole development process in the open from the beginning. So actually all the book trackers that we have are in an open source book tracker. You can go and see all the books that we have. Pretty much all the HPE team that is developing the software stack that we're talking about, 70 plus people right now, last time you checked. They're actually developing the source code in the open side. They're filing the box in the open side. Everything's been done in the open side. So there are instructions in the webpage how to get started. For development process, we actually pick up in the development process from OpenStack. So we take the way that OpenStack develop code using Gerrit for code review, Sewell and Jenkins for continuous integration. And we just take all that and use it in OpenSwitch. So if you are an OpenStack developer, you should be very familiar with the development workflow. But there's also great documentation out there that you can take a look in. And the best place also to start beside the documentation that we have in the website is we have mailing list and we have IRC channel. Most of us are hanging there all day long. We have weekly meetings. You can go to our website also. Look at the mailing list archives. There's plenty of activity and it's very instructive. So it's a great place if you want to, as a developer, you want to start. One of the things that I tell to people is it's usually OpenSwitch is the very first network operating system that you can actually go to a web page and download the code and build it. And you cannot do that today with any other network operating system. You know, even pulling the binaries and everything, we solve it. So that is very powerful for really unleashing innovation in the networking space.
And just to contribute to the answer to the original question of, hey, we have these binaries from, let's say, Broadcom, and how do I download and how do I get them in? The build system that Diego was architecting actually does it all for you. So all you need to do git clone to OPS build repository and do make configure and then make. And Yocto-based build system will bring everything in, will bring these binaries, binary SDK for this specific platform, in which you will have for different other vendors. We'll bring all these binaries, we'll pull in APIs available, source for drivers available, everything will be built. I think right now we are pretty much down to what, 3-4 commands to run in order to start building the image. And right. You will get the image in about an hour on this on reasonable machine.
Yeah, it's taking care of everything. Cross-compilation, build system. We leverage, as Michael said, the Jocto build system. We put some sauce around it to make it a little bit simpler to use. But it's not really rocket science. Not like you have to go through 1,000 steps to make a build. This goes down to Git, make, and you got an image. It's quite useful. And then from there, you can start stepping up on the development process. Right. Another important thing for us is that we actually are open sourcing. We open source the testing framework so that when the developers develop code, they actually get access to our test suite that we're using for test the code in regressions.
And if I want to install this whole thing on an actual top of rack switch, what switch could I take?
So right now, the best supported one is Acton 5712. That's the one that we work constantly on. I think pretty soon we are going, and you can see it on the mailing list, we started actually working on 6712, the Trident 2 Plus box, and I think it's also 7712, the Tomahawk-based switch is going to be supported pretty soon. So 5712 is right now. If you want Trident 2-based top-of-rack switch and you want to start it on, that's 5712, that's the best choice. Trident 2 Plus and Tomahawk-based will be pretty soon. And then once we see other vendors actually work on their drivers, you will see Cavium-based, Mellanox-based, you know, Barefoot-based.
Okay, so last question. And help me out because I have no idea how the whole white box switching thing works. So these switches are probably different enough that based on you supporting Acton switch, I can't just take a Juniper switch and put this code on it and hope that it will run, right?
No. Essentially, they're all the same. So Juniper, Cisco, you know, Open Acton, whatever, they all the same hardware. Now, in order to run the switch on any of them, one, they have to have ONI in order to be able to install the image. And B, they should do simple adjustments to the drivers in order to allow things like fans and temperature sensors and stuff like that. So technically, it would require Juniper cooperation in order to allow OpenSwitch to run on Juniper hardware.
So the switching ASIC is the same, but the peripheral thing is like fan control are potentially different. So you can't just take code from one switch and put it on another.
Yeah, there are minor deviations between them. Nothing which is groundbreaking, nothing which is differentiation for any of them, but technically, if they don't cooperate, they make it a little bit differently.
Of course.
So, yeah.
The other way to put it is that if they have an open design, you should be able to do the porting.
Okay, fair enough. Now, I would love to ask you like 20 more questions, but I know we are running out of time and you guys have to go. So just let me know if people want to follow you online or ask you additional questions or get in touch with you. How can they do that?
The best way is mailing list and RC channel. Those are the two very active tools that we're using all day long.
And you go to openswitch.net and you start exploring and you'll find both of them, I guess.
Michael actually gets notifications on his watch. So
exactly. So I'm tracking the RC channel on my watch. So
okay, fair enough. And Chris, you're also on Twitter, right?
At NetmanChris on Twitter. I've actually done in my alter ego as a blogger at controlissueswithak.net some open switch pieces where, you know, some of the stuff that I'm looking at, I am not a C programmer, but there are contributions to be made to open switch that are not necessarily programming. Like documentation, like interoperability, all that kind of stuff. So I encourage anybody who's interested, you know, get involved. You don't have to be a C coder to do that.
And you wouldn't believe how many times I quote your acceptable unit of loss.
Yes, I would. I can actually watch my stats jump every time you do it.
So okay.
Thank you, sir.
So thank you, Chris, for putting this together. Thank you, Michael and Diego, for all the great explanations. And I hope we'll do some other interesting podcast in not-so-distant future.
Thank you for your time. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you.
And David, where can people find you?
So you can find me on my blog, which is ipengineer.net, and I'm also on Twitter, and it's unfortunately still at David John G. I couldn't get my old one back, and yeah, that's that. I'm kind of stuck with it now. How about yourself? Where can we find you, and what are you up to in the next kind of coming weeks?
Vacations. What? I know this will be published after New Year, but vacations are coming, and finally I hope I'll be able to relax. In the meantime, you can always go to blog.ibspace.net and read my rants. And recently, someone triggered an OpenFlow rant, so it will be up there by the time you listen to this. Or you can go to sdn.ibspace.net, where you'll find all my SDN-related blog posts, plus all the webinars, training, workshops, books, everything I ever did on SDN. And, by the way, if you like this podcast, you have to go to podcast.ibspace.net, where you'll find all the previous episodes and the RSS feed, and you can also pull it down into iTunes, which brings me to another point. You should really go to iTunes and rate it so that other people will be able to find the podcast based on your great review. So thank you for doing that. And finally, do keep in mind, we call it software-defined, but as you've heard today, it actually runs on hardware.